Hello, and welcome to the Net Zero Investor podcast. I'm Atharva Deshmukh, the head of research for Net Zero Investor. In today's episode, we're going to talk about wind, or the investment opportunity in wind energy. In recent years, wind has emerged as the second largest source of renewable energy across the world, second to solar. And according to the Global Wind Energy Council, at least at last count, there's 117 gigawatts of wind energy being added each year. Now, 65% of that is coming in from China. So the momentum is strong, but capacity additions need to accelerate. Under the IEA's net zero by 2050 scenario, wind energy installations need to exceed around 350 gigawatts per year by 2030, by the end of this decade. So the rise of wind energy has also increased its investment attractiveness to investors. And investors across the world have been increasing their exposure to this technology through different asset classes, from infrastructure and private markets to public equity investment through listed wind energy companies. So in this episode, we're going to talk about what this opportunity in wind energy is and what's driving it. Joining me today is Peter Boskov, the Chief Commercial Officer at the Export and Investment Fund of Denmark, the EIFO. The EIFO recently provided a $141 million financing for Ørsted's Greater Changhua 4 offshore wind project in Taiwan. And the EIFO has been involved in the financing of over 30% of the world's total offshore wind capacity outside China. So Peter, thank you for joining us and welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So I guess to set the stage for our listeners, could you give us an overview of what the Export and Investment Fund of Denmark is and maybe tell us a bit about what the organization's net zero goals are like?
Yes, I can definitely do that. We are the Export and Investment Fund of Denmark, short EIFO, and we are part official Export Credit Agency of Denmark and we are part National Promotional Bank. So every country in the world, more or less, I mean, with some exceptions, have an official export credit agency where you support your own export sector with financing for the customers of that export sector. So that's part of what we do. A lot of what we do is wind financing, as you said, but also other sectors around the world. We have a global portfolio. And then we also the National Promotional Bank of Denmark. So we make investments in growth companies and startup companies inside Denmark. And we also participate in the financing of energy projects of various kinds in Denmark. So that's part of what we do. We are roughly 400-ish employees and we're headquartered in Denmark. In Copenhagen.
And now let's dig into the topic for today. Let's talk about the wind. So let's start with this trend that we're seeing. Given the rapid expansion of wind energy capacity in the past few years, as I said, what factors do you think explain this trend? Why has this happened now?
Well, I mean, it's true that we've seen a phenomenal growth in the installed capacity of wind energy around the world. And obviously, you know, there have been a lot of drivers to that. And I might add, EIFO as an institution have been central to that sort of development. But obviously the green agenda has been very, very high on the agenda everywhere in Western countries, but also in certain countries in Asia, China. The levelized cost of energy has been decreasing over the last two decades significantly. So it has become a very attractive way of generating electricity. And basically the manufacturers have, by gaining more scale advantage, enabled a fantastic technology that's very, very cost competitive. And then we've also had the tailwind of very low interest rates. Right up until the end of the pandemic, interest rates were very low after the great financial crisis. And then up until that point, that provided a tailwind as well. Because these are very large, very large projects. Those are some of the few drivers. And then there have been financiers such as EIFO available in the market to support the financing of these projects that have enabled this growth in installation around the world.
So one of the things you mentioned was cost competitiveness. So if you could just zoom into that, because it's really interesting to see the competitiveness of wind energy vis-a-vis fossil fuels, historically speaking. And last year, I think the IEA made the case that wind and solar had become now the cheapest forms of energy in terms of its cost of generation, as you mentioned. So what's contributing to wind energy becoming this low-cost, competitive source of electricity? You mentioned scale, you mentioned interest rates. Is there anything additional to that?
No, I think the most important part is economies of scale that we've been able to attain. And that's going to be a force that will continue to drive prices down. So even on offshore wind, which is the more expensive part compared to onshore, there's still quite a lot of room for cost improvements. And I think if we get it right in the sector, we'll see significantly lower levelized cost of energy going forward. So the key there is really scale advantage.
Another interesting factor, I think, is policy support and the role policy plays in incentivizing renewable energy development, broadly speaking. So in the context of wind, I mean, we seem to be in this era of competitive, fragmented green industrial policy exemplified by the IRA in the US. Are green industrial policies increasing the investment attractiveness of wind energy?
Yes, they are. And I think we wouldn't be where we are without green investment policies around the world. It all started out in Denmark, where we supported wind energy, and then slowly other countries adopted a similar approach. And I think even in the US, where the IRA, as you mentioned, is from, they had support for wind energy for a number of years. So even though they're fragmented and you know, you can't have the same rules everywhere, it all helps to support and sustain the sector going forward. And I think wind energy is one of those industries where you needed that support in the beginning, and we still need some policies that support it going forward. But definitely it sets it on course for sort of being a self-sustainable industry in the long term. And there are many, many projects now that actually don't have any support. And we can thank previous years of support for that, because that is really what is enabling the scale economies that I mentioned before.
So another factor, obviously, wind energy seems to have a lot to do with geography. And as I mentioned, China and the APAC region at large seem to be leading the world in wind energy capacity addition. Could you help us make sense of that? Why does that happen?
I agree with that statement, definitely as it pertains to China, because they've built an enormous amount of wind capacity. And I think China, compared to other countries around the world, also democracies, they're very, very good at mobilizing resources. And not only in sort of the industrial segment, but also financially, and then also making the projects available. So, you know, the planning system in China, although I don't know it, you look at what they've achieved over the years, it's just working much, much faster than we see in other areas of the world. So they've done no doubt a phenomenal job there.
Before we get into your project in Taiwan, so there's two types of wind energy, of course, there's onshore and there's offshore. As you mentioned, there's differences in these two forms of wind energy. And historically, I think onshore wind capacity has overshadowed offshore wind capacity. From an investor's point of view, could you explain how the investment opportunity right now differs between onshore and offshore wind?
Onshore and offshore, although fundamentally the same, they are very different. And onshore is easy today. You don't take a lot of construction risk there. You can basically build for most of the year, but the turbines are smaller. The wind resource may not be as strong as it is offshore. And then when you go offshore into the sea, complexities arise. So you need to fix the foundation at the bottom of the sea. And then you erect a tower and you erect this giant turbine that is probably today, you know, two or three times larger than the biggest onshore turbine. And you need to operate on the sea, so with vessels and so on. So you're a little bit exposed to the weather and the seasons as they change over time. So it is much more complicated. But what offshore does is that it enables you to invest in wind at a very, very significant scale. And also, if you look at where most people in the world live, they live in cities that are on the coast. So if you can build offshore wind relatively close to those cities, then you're solving a lot of the energy needs that these cities have. And it might even be much easier to solve it with offshore compared to onshore, which will be far, far away from where the energy is consumed. But it is tricky, and offshore is trickier. And you do expose, as an investor, you do expose yourself to construction risk, which can be difficult. And there are some of the supply chains within offshore wind, for instance, on installation vessels, that is under pressure, simply because the capacity doesn't match the number of projects. So it is a more tricky proposition to do offshore, but you get a serious and very significant scale advantage.
And the project, Greater Changhua 4, of course, is an offshore wind project. So could you give us an overview of what the project is and what role AFO's financing is playing?
So it's a project in Taiwan Taiwan has built out 6 significant offshore wind farms before this, and it's a project that is being built and part-owned by the Danish developer Ørsted. It's 580 megawatt capacity, and it's using Siemens Energy, Siemens Gamesa turbines, 14 megawatt turbines, 42 turbines in total. We participate in this loan, or the senior financing for the transaction, together with a number of other export credit agencies from Belgium, Australia. So a lot of like-minded financiers. And it obviously involves export of turbines from Denmark, but also there's a cable laying ship that comes from Denmark. And then Ørsted has a long-term operations and management agreement to basically run this wind farm. The offtake, so selling of the power, is to the big Taiwan semiconductor company, where they have a long-term agreement to be supplied the power. Green power into their factories locally in Taiwan. So a very nice project. Taiwan is an example of how it can be difficult to build an offshore wind farm because the weather season changes a lot. So in the winter, in the fall, and sometimes in the spring, you have very difficult wind conditions. So it's difficult to install. So the construction windows or installation windows are very narrow. And that's why we like to go with very skilled developers, and Ørsted is one of those developers that are very skilled in that geography. So this is a very good project for us.
And that corporate power purchase agreement with TSMC that you mentioned, in terms of demand for wind energy by large corporates such as TSMC, how important is that in terms of shaping investment attractiveness in the wind energy projects?
It's extremely important. We talked in the beginning about how green policies have worked to enable the installation of wind capacity around the world. And the next step, and this was actually our first deal with corporate power purchasing agreements in Taiwan. But the next step is really when government stops supporting the projects with guaranteed power prices, corporations like TSMC, you have Microsoft, Meta, Amazon, Novo Nordisk, other companies that have net zero aspirations, they want to get access to green electrons everywhere in the world. And those ambitions that these companies have will enable more build out of wind capacity around the world. There's no doubt.
I want to conclude our conversation by maybe looking ahead to 2030, because I think we started with this thing about by 2030, the pace of deployment needs to accelerate. So there seems to be, through our conversation, I think we've highlighted some clear signs of momentum in wind energy, but there are also some barriers. So if you were to list the top 3 factors that you think could accelerate investment in wind energy by 2030, what might they be?
Well, I think it's true that there might be some barriers. And really, to get all this wind installed, we need to build more momentum in offshore wind. At one point, you run out of suitable sites onshore. And in order to get offshore going, we really think at IFO that we need a permitting regime that is much more predictable and smooth and efficient. And this is not only in Europe, it's also in US, elsewhere in Asia. Because investors, when they start bidding for projects and so on, they need that kind of predictability to start spending the costs that are involved in this. So permitting and maybe even announcing which sites are coming up early on is a very, very important part of getting more predictability in this sector. Predictability is also important for the manufacturers so that they can better plan their production. And the more production we can plan long-term out in the future, the larger the scale economies and the scale of economy benefits are going to be. So that's very important. Then I think the second one, we have to realize and accept that there's been some inflation over the last 2 or 3 years. So it's become more expensive to build offshore, to some extent also onshore. And that means that, you know, we have to accept that the tariffs, you know, the price for the electricity that we're going to pay, it's going to have to be a little bit higher in the medium term. Because when you have projects that are just too squeezed, you squeeze the supply chain, you squeeze investors, you squeeze everything. And it's going to lead to a delay in the build out of capacity. So it's not to say that this has to be a, you know, golden investment for everybody involved, but there needs to be a little bit more juice to incentivize quicker and, you know, faster installment. So we have to accept maybe pay a little bit more for this green electrons, at least in the medium term. And then we need even more of the financial sector to play their part. I think 70% of what we do at IFO is wind. I would love to see more financial institutions, export credit agencies acting more like IFO, maybe IFO together with export credit agencies. It's all government money, right? We run it commercially, so it's not subsidized, but it's basically government financial institutions that bring capacity to the financing market. And maybe we should think about what joint approaches can we do, for instance, in Europe to provide even more financing capacity to this market so that we enable faster installation. And definitely at IFO, we have some of Europe's leading project finance capabilities, and we are definitely able to take on more projects with that skill that we built out over years. And maybe also bringing more European financial capacity in play. So I think that we have more joint cooperation amongst, for instance, countries in Europe in providing this finance. We could do things much faster. So those are three of the most important, I think.
Great. So predictability, incentives and accepting perhaps a higher price point in the medium term, and collaboration between different financiers looking ahead to 2030. That's a great note to bring this episode to a close. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed the conversation. Peter, that was great. Thank you for joining us and sharing your insights.
Thanks a lot.